Hello and welcome to the Politico Nerdcast, where we bring you inside the stories of the White House and geek out on the amazing circus of American politics. Yes, we changed the intro, but I'm committed to that clown music. It's Thursday, November 10th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. 53. That's the percentage of white women Donald Trump won. 6.6 million, the number of people who voted for Obama in 2012 who did not vote for Clinton. 240, the number of Electoral College votes that the Republican National Committee's own model predicted as Trump's ceiling. And 2.3%, that's the percentage of American newspapers that endorsed Trump. So grab your calculators and enjoy the Politico Nerdcast. Here we go again. Hello, Charlie Mattesian.
Hi, Kristen.
Hey, Scott Bland.
Hello.
Eli Stokols.
Hey.
Hadass Gold.
Hi.
And Ken Vogel.
Psyched to be here in Trump's America.
This is our election post-mortem episode. We'll run through the numbers that we think yielded the Republican sweep. Remember to send us questions about 2016 for next week's Q&A show. Send them to nerdcast@politico.com. Now, our first data point. 53. That's the percentage of white women Donald Trump won, 53%. This represents the beginning of the story of the failure of the pregame predictions. Charlie, this is a group Clinton was supposed to win. Anecdotally, we knew Clinton had problems with white women, both young women and women of my age and older, but not the kind of trouble that would generate a 10% margin in Trump's favor. How did this play out across the battlegrounds?
Well, what was really surprising about it was this came in the face of all of those controversies that you would have thought would have submarined his ability to compete with women, whether it was Access Hollywood, whether it was the repeated accusations of sexual assault, whether it was the kind of language he used, whether it was the kinds of things he said to women and about women. None of it mattered at the end of the day. And what we saw was in especially working class areas where Donald Trump ran really well, it didn't really matter in the end, that ultimately the power of his message of trade, economic populism, raging against the establishment, all of that really overcame any worries, any frustrations that people had with the kind of things that he was saying about women, that women had. For many of them, ultimately their conclusion was that, hey, that's how guys talk, and we understand what we're getting.
It's also, to some extent, I think, a validation of this argument that Trump supporters were making all along, that women, Hispanics, others had the same economic concerns, and that those were the driving, their animating sort of voting concerns, not any of the personality-driven disputes that Democrats emphasize so repeatedly in such a concerted effort that maybe they should have spent more time addressing some, invalidating some of the economic concerns that these people, including women, were raising.
I also wonder that in a lot of areas, Hillary Clinton did not give women, conservative women, very many options. Meaning, if you were maybe not even a strong conservative, if you were center right or vaguely conservative, she wasn't really an option in a lot of ways because she went farther on the left on abortion. So if you had some pro-life tendencies, you really didn't have an option of voting for her, farther than past Democratic nominees, that is. And also, if you were a pro-gun woman, you know, again, she went farther left, I think, than Democratic nominees in the past, even Obama in 2008. And so maybe you didn't have a viable option.
That's a very interesting point. And I wonder, as you say that, I think back to the RNC, the convention over the summer, where Ivanka Trump gave a speech that was immediately criticized by conservatives as incredibly progressive. You'll remember she was making promises about things that are typically very important to people with families, work-life balance issues, child care issues. And that's the kind of issue that speaks directly to some of the women in the demographic group that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a really smart point you're making, because I'd forgotten about that play, which was widely panned by, you know, in the media, but maybe it did have much more resonance than we knew in pockets of the country where women's issues aren't the same way that we define them in the elite centers of the media, whether it's New York or Washington, D.C. or anywhere else.
Yeah, I think I think the women's vote just gets to kind of something that we saw all over the place, I guess, which is just the number of people across groups who said that they viewed Trump unfavorably or often viewed both candidates unfavorably and broke for him anyways. You know, I think I can't remember the exact percentage, but Trump got, you know, a significant number of votes among people in the exit poll who said that they didn't think he was fit to serve.
I think one thing we're overlooking here is that is the impact of Kellyanne Conway, brought in the last 2 months of the campaign as, quote, the campaign manager. But really, she was the top surrogate. She was on TV every second. And that's not like that's not a campaign manager. That's somebody carrying a message and delivering a message and making a candidate who's really toxic with a lot of women voters acceptable, because here was this seemingly normal, kind of likable, indefatigably optimistic person sitting here and really as skillfully as anyone could explaining and deflecting away from some of Trump's really horrific misogynistic statements and really turning the focus on Hillary Clinton. I think she did more than any other single person in the campaign to make it okay for women to vote for Hillary Clinton. And when the bottom fell out for Hillary at the end because of the emails and people, you know, Hillary never has had a lot of like warmth and made people sort of feel warm and fuzzy about supporting her. There's just something that wasn't there. And when I think the election turned at the end, when people were reminded about a lot of the negatives and things they don't like about Hillary Clinton, you know, Kellyanne Conway's work on the airwaves, she'd done all the spade work to make it okay for people at that moment to say, okay, you know, this guy does, I can forgive some of these things, I can give him a chance, whatever that sort of mental rationalizing was. I think you have to give her a ton of credit for carrying that message. And she wasn't the only surrogate. I mean, Charlie, you're right. Omarosa was out there publicly. Ivanka Trump was obviously sort of the, of all the children, the one that they wanted to put forward, the one who gave, had the most primetime speaking slot at the convention, who stood behind her father in suburban Philly 6-7 weeks ago when he outlined his child care tax credit plan and sat there over his shoulder as he spoke and was credited by Trump for saying, this is my daughter's idea. This is important to her. She convinced me, you know, she was maybe not comfortable, you know, fully carrying a lot of water for the campaign at times, worried about what it would do to her own and to the family brand. But she was also very effective. But I think, you know, it starts with Kellyanne.
And the other thing, just to pile on to Eli's point, is think about who a lot of voters saw as the face of the campaign, aside from Omarosa, Ivanka, Kellyanne. Also, many of those new widely panned commentators on the cable networks were all women, whether it was on CNN or elsewhere. And that is the face that consistently went out about the Trump campaign, maybe lessening the sting of the remarks a little bit. And also, one of the things that I saw that I thought was really fascinating was at the convention. I talked to a number of Republicans who felt that they put a lot of stock into his family. They liked the kids. They liked Ivanka a lot. And there was one woman in particular, and I remember her because she was the sheriff of Chester County. And I know that she introduced Trump at one of the rallies there, I think. And what she told me was she loved Trump because she felt that, you know, for all his flaws, and there were many, she liked the message, but she also thought, and she said she was speaking for other people that she knew in the Pennsylvania delegation, that the family really spoke well about him as a father, that no matter how bad he might be caricatured, how bad could he be if his kids turned out to be pretty good?
You know, I'll give it to all you guys that he to some extent had people around him who sought to and maybe did a little bit soften the edges, women around him who softened the edges of some of the comments that he made that really, you know, can only be seen as anti-woman or derogatory, demeaning towards women. Nonetheless, what the exit polls show is that that wasn't the overriding factor in women voting for him. Women voting for him were willing to overlook those, not because there are people around them, but because the people around him that softened the edges, but because the economic appeal and the anti-establishment appeal to the disaffected, people who felt disaffected and marginalized, that trumped pun intended, any of the personal stuff. And, you know, just to drive that point home, I mean, Hillary Clinton ran overtly wrapping herself in the feminist flag and had all these commercials, and so much of her rhetoric was directly appealing to women on the basis of gender and this idea that, like, you know, what her election would say about the place of women in America, the final glass ceiling, all that stuff. And that was not sufficient to overcome the economic anxiety that women felt.
I think that's such an important point. And I think it really speaks to the not just the fact that there is surprise and shock among Clinton supporters having lost this election, but the depth of it at this point. I think, you know, there are people for whom it was very hard to get past the comments for Trump, and that was the beginning and the end of the conversation about him for them. And I think they're having a lot of trouble understanding that it wasn't for a lot of people.
Let's talk about white men. And the data point I want to use is 31. That's the percentage of white males that Hillary Clinton won, according to exit polls. That's 4 points behind Obama's already weak performance in 2012. It's 5 points behind where Al Gore was, 7% behind Bill in 1996. Scott, jump in here. What is the takeaway from the loss of white male support for the Democratic nominees?
The takeaway is that the prevailing Democratic thinking about the white vote after Obama's reelection was badly flawed. There was a thought after President Obama was reelected in 2012 that he had essentially plumbed the depths of Democratic support among white men, and that the, or whites in general, really, and that, you know, the next nominee, which I think at that point people already expected to be Clinton, would be able to recover some of that support and build it on top of the kind of rising American electorate coalition, you know, African-American, Hispanic, millennials that Obama had really built his campaign around. And obviously that turned out to be badly wrong. And, you know, the extent to which that played into campaign strategy, I think, is a real open question. You know, there have been some stories about in the last few days about Bill Clinton, who ended up being kind of a marginal figure from a strategic perspective in the campaign, pushing to no avail to have Hillary Clinton focus a little bit more on the white vote, especially the white working class.
Charlie, I want you to jump in here because this was not just, we're not just talking about white people in rural America. This was an urban problem for her as well.
Yeah, the number really shocked me that she would run so poorly. So we are talking about the major party nominee, a major party nominee in the U.S. winning less than a third of white males. And that was pretty remarkable. I mean, on the one hand, she was always going to lose that. That is the fate of Democrats, the way the country aligns itself these days. But to lose, but to show up with 31%, it's just sort of breathtaking. And I think it's partly a reflection of, a reflection of a lot of things. You know, one of them, let's get this right on the table right now, sexism. I mean, I think that, you know, we can sit here and argue all day how much, what the level of it was, but let's not deny that that's there, okay? I mean, I think everybody can stipulate it's there. We don't know how much of it, but you know it's there. And in the same way that, you know, race was an element with Obama elections. But either way, so I think that's part of it. But I also think it's the issue set. I think going to the left on guns and some other issues. And the other thing that struck me was I was always surprised during the campaign at the way they framed Hillary Clinton. I don't know that it really had a whole lot of appeal to male voters, the framing her as an advocate for children and families, which is, you know, very laudable, but I don't think that's something that resonates with a lot of male voters. And, you know, I know when I would see some of those ads, it, you know, the first thing that came to my mind, I don't know about you guys, was The Simpsons, you know, like Mayor Quimby, like, oh, I love the children and the families, like,
you gotta do the voice, Charlie.
Yeah, I can't do it very well, but let's just stipulate everyone loves children and families. Like, to me, if I love my children, I love my family, you know. But what I was waiting for the ads that I think would have been very effective, especially with white males, speaking as a white guy. The ad is like, she is the baddest ass on the scene. She will kick everyone's butt. She is so much more qualified than everyone else. She will rain holy hell on terrorists that look askance at our country. And you could have easily made that based on her record, yet we didn't see that.
And ironically, that was sort of the approach that she took in 2008, where she did, where she eschewed running as a woman, and she tried to project toughness. Maybe a little bit of that would have worked better this time. I got a stat for you, though, on this. This is from our friend David Paul Kuhn, former Politico, wrote a whole book on white working class voters called The Neglected Voter. He sent me a statistic that I think really drives this home. Trump won a larger share of white working class men than any presidential candidate of either party since World War II. His support surpassed the landslide victories of LBJ, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan. He also won white working class women at levels unseen in three decades. So this sort of turns the conventional wisdom on its ear, which Scott was talking about, that this new, what liberals call the rising American electorate, this new coalition, the Obama coalition, if you will, would put the Republicans at a permanent disadvantage because white voters and white men, their base, were becoming an increasingly smaller part of the electorate. Obviously, they were big enough in this case.
And actually, Steve Shale, the Florida Democrat who was Obama's state director in Florida in 2008 and Obama advisor in 2012 and was providing very, very detailed, interesting updates on the early voting that we saw in Florida has been warning against this for years, right? It's that, you know, the strength among the Latino vote and the African American community only gets you so far, and you have to, you know, you have to have a baseline of support among white voters too, and she fell below that baseline.
Let's get to our next segment about the turnout gap. The data point is 6.6 million. That's the number of people who voted for Obama in 2012 who did not vote for Clinton. This is a phenomenon that played out across the country. Scott, 44,000 is how many votes Obama got more than Clinton in Milwaukee. Tell us about some other urban areas where she lost ground versus the president.
Yeah, so I think there are two sides to this story, right, of these millions of voters who voted for Obama and didn't vote for Clinton. Some of them didn't show up. Some of them voted for Trump. And so if we look at a place like Milwaukee, where the, you know, turnout was Clinton actually did just about as well as Obama among the people who did vote, but turnout was way down, ultimately down enough that that might be the margin for the whole state there, right? But then also, you know, if you go kind of elsewhere throughout the Great Lakes region, you go to Wayne County in Detroit, Michigan, again, turnout fell, and her support relative to Obama fell a little bit. But then you go to a place like Flint, Michigan, and Genesee County, turnout fell a lot, but also her support from Obama fell a lot. And this is a county that is about 21% black, 73% white, mostly working class. And, you know, again, it gets, you can kind of piece together bit by bit how this happened. There were some turnout problems. There were obviously people who voted for Obama and ended up voting for Trump. And in combination, that spelled doom in those three Great Lakes states that seem to have flipped.
I was there with Donald Trump in Flint, Michigan, roughly 2 months ago. Okay. And he got booed in a black church, did a real quick tour of the water plant, was on the ground for 2 hours. The people lining the streets were wearing Obama Biden shirts. They were protesting Donald Trump. This did not seem like a place where he would be able to really make inroads. I think what tells you something is they were wearing Obama Biden shirts. They weren't wearing Hillary Clinton shirts. The communities here,
man,
there was some, right? Obama was there over the weekend at the end of this campaign saying, don't forget about what my administration did for the auto industry in this you know, state. I have credibility here. Listen to me. It wasn't the president. It wasn't the past 8 years. It was Hillary Clinton. And I think that's why Donald Trump was able to do just well enough. It wasn't Donald Trump. It wasn't him making inroads. It wasn't him, you know, connecting with voters in Michigan.
That's right.
With new voters in Michigan.
This was a turnout issue, not a flip the vote issue.
And it was the turnout issue was about turn off, people being turned off or not motivated to go out and stand in line and vote for Hillary Clinton.
I disagree with that a little bit. I mean, I think turnout definitely played a big role here, but I think there was some vote flipping. And actually, I think it gets back to something Charlie was saying before about just the message of the campaign. Like, it's easy to forget in all our talk about the coalition politics and everything of the Obama reelection, but that he ran as an economic populist in Ohio and Michigan on saving the auto industry, and that, you know, Romney was this corporate raider who wasn't for the working man. And that, you know, there wasn't as much of that.
I don't think the data bears that out. I think the difference in how many votes Barack Obama got versus Hillary Clinton is greater than the margin by which Donald Trump won. You know, the question is not, right? I mean, the question is really not about how many people voted for Obama who then turned and voted for Donald Trump. It's more, and we've seen this not just in Detroit. We've seen it not just with African Americans. We see, you know, the share of Latinos, the young people who voted for Obama who 4 and 8 years later did not vote for Hillary Clinton. That's a turnout problem, not a vote switch.
I think there are a few different ways that you can add it up. I mean, I think you're definitely right about the turnout, and it depends state by state on some of the, you know, I think Wisconsin, for example, like you can definitely lay it at the feet of turnout, like we just talked about with Milwaukee.
I think it can be both. I mean, I think we're talking about Wisconsin, the state that Donald Trump got so much egg on his face during the primary. It's a terrible state in terms of the traditional Republican electorate and the wow counties. They didn't like Donald Trump, and yet he won Wisconsin, a state everyone thought would go blue. So you look in the upper Midwest, and I think it is both, right? It's a turnout issue, and it's a persuasion issue. I think one thing that Trump did well, you know, Barack Obama did understand, Scott's right, he did understand economic populism and the power of that. And in this campaign, Hillary Clinton was not able, for whatever reason, to articulate that message as well as Donald Trump. We all go back to 2012. We remember the exit surveys and everybody saying, who really cares about me, right? Mitt Romney, the 47%. Nobody thought Mitt Romney cared about them. People believed Obama cared about them. And in this election, Donald Trump, he may have said a lot of outlandish stuff, but at the end of the day, people sensed a passion from him and the populism that was, you know, at the fore of his campaign and his message that they didn't sense quite as clearly, I think, from Hillary.
Charlie.
To me, it's an enthusiasm issue in that people loved Obama. People liked Hillary. And there's a big difference. Maybe it's just at the margins, but that can be enough oftentimes. I often thought of it as the, you know, when I thought about black turnout, it often occurred to me how similar in many ways it would be to John F. Kennedy and Catholics in 1960. And the similarities there would be, like, if you were a Catholic Democrat back then, you loved Kennedy and you liked LBJ. You know, it's not comparable. And so it's going to be hard to hit those same heights, even if you're getting top of the ticket support from the president. And, you know, Hillary didn't do that badly in a lot of places, but she did badly enough that when you put it all together, it didn't help. Meaning she was down a tick here and there, down a percentage point here, down a percentage point here, but that was not across the board. She ran better than Obama in a lot of the big counties in California. She carried storied Orange County for the first time in 80 years, first Democrat in 80 years to break through Orange County. You would have thought that if anyone was going to do it, it would be Barack Obama, but it was actually Hillary Clinton who did it. She ran pretty well in some of the big Texas counties, but again, in places like Philadelphia, in places like Milwaukee, she did not run nearly as well as Barack Obama. Having said that, though, again, she was not exceptionally weak in the big urban areas. Like in some of the southern states, you can see in counties like Mecklenburg, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, or Wake County, Hillary ran ahead of Barack Obama. So it's very uneven.
But critically, in Wake County, turnout declined almost 9 percentage points. And you know, I think that again, it's this push and pull, right? I'm looking here, she ran 3 points ahead of Obama in Wake County, but turnout was 72% instead of 81%. That's a lot of votes in a big county. It wasn't the case everywhere. In Northern Virginia, in the big Florida metro areas, turnout was up and Clinton improved on Obama's margins. It just wasn't enough.
And it was narrow. I mean, what we're talking about at the end of the day, you know, is maybe one out of every 100 votes going the other way, or you know, just a smidge more people turning out. Because when you look at the electoral margin, okay, 250,000 votes is the total number of combined votes by which Trump won Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. That translates to 75 electoral votes. I mean, that's the election, and it's less than 250,000 votes combined in those four states that you add up, that's Trump's margin. And so the Democrats had the machine, they had the campaign. I mean, the RNC deserves credit too and for building a turnout operation. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, both campaigns try to turn their voters out. And in terms of, like Charlie said, enthusiasm and motivation, I mean, the Democrats just missed.
Ken, what about the Republican turnout machine?
Well, actually, I mean, I want to address for a minute this idea that, like, Democrats dropped the ball on turnout, because, in fact, we did exit polls in collaboration with Morning Consult that showed that Hillary Clinton's, that 17% of voters said that they were contacted by Clinton's campaign, and that only 8% said that they were contacted by Trump's or you know, forces allied with Trump. So that suggested that the Democratic machine, the Democratic get out the vote machine, was actually more than twice as effective as Donald Trump, if you just want to look at that metric. Nonetheless, that was not sufficient to sort of, you know, to offset some of these demographic challenges that we just talked about in regards to Trump and the populism speaking to some of these disaffected white voters. That said, there is also some credit that should be given to the RNC in particular, because when we talk about turnout and get out the vote machine, Trump's campaign did really next to nothing. I mean, it was shocking and worrying for Republicans when he became the nominee how little he had invested in his get out the vote infrastructure. Again, the RNC really, really did help him make up the difference. And this was sort of a controversial decision, based on a controversial decision that Reince Priebus, the chairman, made after the 2012 election. You remember the autopsy where they were talking about some of these demographic challenges in a way that they did not fully, none of us, but they did not fully anticipate Trump's ability to mobilize the you know, disaffected white voters. But what they did see was that all their spending on television ads, and maybe to some extent digital ads, were not as effective as what they had hoped, and that they thought that they could have more impact if they redirected some of that spending to the ground operation. So starting right after the 2012 election, they started pouring money into the ground operation, building what they deemed to be sort of a permanent community-based organizing effort. And the results were that by election day, they had 7,600 paid employees and fellows in 315 field offices around the country, but concentrated in these battleground states. They knocked on 24 million doors and made 26 million phone calls.
Yeah, the foresight of Reince Priebus, I think, you know, needs to be recognized. And you're right about that. And I think that, you know, we reported that in the last weeks before election day, Trump's campaign was still trying to hire field staff in Florida. I mean, everybody looked at that and said, you got to be kidding me, right? How lackadaisical is that? There's no way they can win. I think, you know, the Clinton campaign was deeply invested in data and campaign science and metrics. And, okay, here's what we have to do. Here are our voters. We have to turn them out. But, you know, you can't put guns to people's heads and make them. You can call them every day. You can knock on their door. I mean, at the end of the day, Donald Trump sort of shrugged his shoulders. And, you know, there was that online meme, that Twitter joke about, oh, Donald Trump's ground game doesn't exist here. It exists in our hearts. Well, it was sort of, you know, what do you know? Elite establishment media types mocking Donald Trump's refusal to sort of buy into campaign science. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you have to recognize one of those things. I mean, this is a very unique phenomenon that other politicians and presidential candidates probably will not be able to copy going forward. But it worked for Donald Trump when Kellyanne Conway, I'm going to toot her horn again, when she was on the air over and over again talking about, you got to look at all these people going to our rallies, when they sit there and stand in line for 6 hours to see Donald Trump, when they wait for him at the end of the day till 1 a.m. when his plane is late. It tells you something about the enthusiasm and support for him. His support was deep. And those people, you didn't need to mobilize them. You didn't need to mobilize them to turn out or even remind them
they
were going to be there.
They did, in fact, collect data from those people at those rallies. And, you know, I think it's questionable the degree to which Trump's campaign could have actually used that data to mobilize the vote and to target people. But it's indisputable that the RNC's data targeting analytics operation could and did use that data, and you saw a difference in the data collection and the modeling once Trump's campaign merged its operations with the RNC after the convention. That's when they sort of, and it was an untold story, that's when they sort of started to be able to take advantage of some of this data science in a way that we thought Hillary Clinton had this huge advantage in.
Before we move away from this, Scott, I want you to tell us why Nevada was different.
I think ultimately, you know, it's the most Latino heavy swing state, and Democrats have a big ground game that's tested of their own there. And I think it came through. I mean, this is the state that's furthest along in this demographic shift that we're talking about. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, it makes sense that it's a little different. We've actually seen in each of the past couple elections when Republicans have had good results nationwide, the wave has kind of broken on the Rockies a little bit, and Nevada and California have been insulated from that. And so once again, we saw pretty bad night for Democrats nationwide, not just at the presidential level, but you cross the Rockies, you get to Nevada. Clinton carries the state. They elect a Democrat to the Senate, the first Latina senator ever, Catherine Cortez Masto, flip two House seats, flip the state Senate, flip the state House.
Yeah, that's a pretty good night. Job. I think, you know, one thing that's fascinating, just to go back, I mean, a month ago when the Access Hollywood videotape came out, Joe Heck, Senate candidate in Nevada, came out and said, okay, that's it, I can't support him. And other Republicans did too, and some went back on it. Joe Heck did not. Okay, when you look at the three seats, the three Republican senators who lost on Tuesday night or Wednesday morning or whenever these races were called, the common thread between Heck and Ayotte and Kirk is that all of them opposed Donald Trump.
Well, also, Kirk and Ayotte ran ahead of Trump.
Right.
Heck is the only battleground. One of two battleground Republican Senate candidates who actually ran behind Trump.
I just do think it's funny when everybody was thinking about, you know, the narrative for the entire election was Donald Trump's going to kill the Republican Senate. He doesn't have any coattails. He has negative coattails. Turned out maybe he had some coattails.
Paul speaks to the change in tune of Paul Ryan yesterday. Charlie.
On the Nevada question, I just think that there is a simple explanation for why that was an anomaly in a lot of ways. And I think it's an old school explanation, which is Harry Reid is an old timey political boss. We will not see many people like him going forward. He is a guy who owns that state lock, stock, and barrel. He can speak to the rurals because he was born in a small town. You can take him to the urban areas. He lived there, he was born there, he understands the story, so he can work well in the Cal counties, as they're called. He can go up to the Reno's Washoe County. He is wired in Clark County. And here's the other thing, the really important thing about political machines and about political bosses and party leaders who have success and who are remembered as great visionary leaders. This was true of Len Hall at the Republican National Committee in the 1950s, and it's true of all great political leaders in terms of political leaders that master the mechanics. Reid understands where Nevada is going. Nevada is still small enough that you can have a lot of control if you're a powerful boss like Reid. He understands the demographics there. He understands the future there is Hispanic growth. He is grooming a new generation of Hispanic leaders there, and he's not afraid to give up power in all the places where parties have been successful. This is true whether it's Republicans or Democrats. It takes somebody who understands that the future may not be my kind of people, but this is what the future looks like, and I'm going to prepare the party for it, and I think that's what you're seeing right now and explains the results in Nevada in a lot of ways.
Let's get to the next segment. We need to talk about the polling fail. The data point I'm going to use to open this up is 1.9. That's the lead Real Clear Politics polling average gave Clinton in Pennsylvania on the morning of Election Day, and that was the most conservative of the polling averages. Charlie, where does the story of the polling fail actually begin?
Where do we even begin this discussion? It's hard to say that the pollsters failed in so many different ways. I think we're not going to know for a couple weeks, maybe even longer. The polling industry itself understands it's got a real problem in the wake of Brexit and Colombia and Romney 2012 and all of this. And I think you could see from they issued a statement yesterday, their own sort of version of mea culpa and promising that they're going to look into this. And I think you'll see, you know, some real hand wringing over this. in the coming weeks and months. You know, among the questions are going to be, were they accurate on Latinos? Are they even able to gauge it in and the sort of unique characteristics of that demographic? Are they capturing them? Were they able to capture the so-called shy Trumpers? Was there some sort of Bradley effect going on? Were they not reaching those people, or were those people not being honest? But I think the other last point I would make is that one thing that has been overlooked is, while there were a ton of polls in these states affecting these polling averages in the final days, most of them were automated calls or automated polls and internet polls and things like that. There was a glut of that stuff, and they're not nearly as reliable as the big live caller surveys. And that's in part because those take a lot of money and nobody has the money to roll them out anymore. So I think that probably played a role in it as well.
I think there's a couple things going on here, and it's going to take a long time to unpack. And it's not nearly as simple as just the polls got it wrong. We don't know the extent to which and there was an actual late surge of support for Trump, or whether this was there the whole time and people were missing it. That's one big question that, you know, people are going to struggle to answer. You know, I think another one is that we talked about at the top of the show how all these different groups, how all these different demographic groups vote, and how, you know, each one of them, it seems like, is pushing more and more toward basically everyone in a certain group voting one way or another. And that makes the demographic makeup of these polls really, really important, right? Where, you know, you're essentially talking about a point more or less of African-American turnout or makeup of a poll, or Hispanic turnout, or working class white turnout on the other side, essentially just adds a point in one direction or the other to one candidate's margins. And so the coming up, you know, figuring out exactly who should be in it, who is a likely voter, and we've been talking also about the turnout, is hugely important to these polls. And I think, you know, it seems like some of them probably missed it by just enough to cause this kind of problem.
Charlie, one of the things that we were noticing on Tuesday night is that the states that had the states that allowed voters to vote early, that were very lenient, that had loose rules on that, Hillary Clinton seemed to be doing better in those states. The states that had stricter rules on early voting or had no early voting at all went to Trump. What do you read into that?
I think it probably speaks to the state of intel about those states, meaning the states that had early voting and good data, everyone had a pretty good idea of where things stood, because you could look at the ballots that were cast, that were returned. In some states, you could figure out the racial breakdown of who was casting them, all that. Whereas the bigger industrial states, you know, they have old-fashioned rules, and, you know, they're all built, you know, decades ago and designed to keep people out and not allow people to vote and sustain party hegemony, big party hegemony. So nobody really knew, I think. And I think only later on in the campaign did folks understand, like, wait a minute, we have a Pennsylvania problem and we have a Michigan problem. Because remember, it wasn't Michigan and Pennsylvania. Michigan was a joke. Like, nobody thought about Michigan till the end. And I was laughing at the idea that the Trump folks would talk about Michigan. Laughing. It just seemed hilarious to me. You had dozens and dozens and dozens of polls over months, all of which said Clinton was winning. Then all of a sudden, on the Wednesday or Thursday before Election Day, I read a report in the Detroit newspapers that Bill Clinton shows up unannounced in Detroit and has a meeting with Democratic leaders and African-American clergy leaders to talk. This was not on the schedule. So that's late. Then Hillary goes to Detroit. Then she schedules another event on the Monday before Election Day. So clearly they saw something very late, not early, late. They might have known that earlier if they had early voting there.
Scott, who got this right? Did anybody get this right?
You know, there are scattered pollsters out there who did, you know, and their final pre-election polls kind of nail the some of the results. There's this group that, frankly, I've never heard of, Trafalgar Group Information, that are, you know, a Republican firm that was putting out poll numbers that ended up being right. I think the thing is, you know, we don't know why they got it right. We don't know if they got it right for the right reasons, or, you know, anyone can put polling information out there. You know, anyone can buy the technology to do, especially automated call polling at this point. And so it's a really tricky question.
Let's get to our final segment, the media effect. And the data point I want to use here is 27%. That's the percentage of Democrats who have, quote, a lot of trust in the information from national news organizations. And that is the high water mark. The comparables here, 15% for Republicans and 13% of independents say so. You know, Hadas, when you look at this, at the coverage of the 2016 campaign, do you think we did our jobs poorly?
No, not entirely. I think what the media did right and did well was reporting on the candidates themselves. We now know a lot about Donald Trump. We know a lot about Hillary Clinton, what they're like, what their histories are like, what people who work with them say they're like. Donald Trump especially sat for many interviews. Whether people think that the media didn't do their job in covering Trump or whether they think the cable networks did too much in giving him just free rein, I think people knew who he was. And a lot of people in the exit polls did say that they, I think someone was like 60% or something said that they didn't necessarily trust him or, you know that he was always truthful. I think what the media did not do well, and we're seeing a lot of this today, is report on the voters. And that's because we relied on the polls. Media always relies on the polls because it is hard to go out there and talk to, you can go out and talk to a couple voters, but you don't know if that's necessarily representative of an entire community. Part of this is because we have lost so much of the local media coverage. You know, the big national papers no longer have correspondents in every state or in every even region necessarily. So they're just not living and breathing and really hearing those communities. And clearly the pollsters are wrong, and the media had relied so much on the pollsters to do that for us. And I think what's really interesting here is there have been some outlets that did do stories that seem to capture that this was coming. Michael Moore, interestingly, is one of them back in July. Although he was a Clinton supporter in the end and said that he thought she was probably going to win, he wrote 5 Reasons Why Trump Will Win back in July. One reporter I want to point out is this reporter, Selena Zito. She writes for the New York Post and for The Atlantic, and she did a lot of on-the-ground reporting. For example, in September, why Democrats in Western Pennsylvania are voting Trump. In August, stumped by Trump's success, take a drive outside U.S. cities. And she was doing a lot of this observational reporting, just driving around and talking to people, and she sensed that this was coming. And it seemed as though the rest of the media did not do that as much.
The Selena Zito example is really smart, Hadas, because and to me that shows the exact blind spot that we have in the media. I read a lot of her stuff, and I don't know her, but I've met her before on the campaign trail, and I read her stuff. You know, she's a center right journalist. So I don't know if she would describe herself that way, but I think a lot of her stuff feels that way. But it's always deeply reported, and she's really smart and really interesting and insightful. And what struck me about her coverage was I think it was that Atlantic story that she did, or a story she did, that she got savaged on Twitter by elite media journalists for writing. And that to me, when I read all the abuse she was taking simply for writing a story based on her observations that were very different from the elite media. That's when I began to think, like, wow, I wonder, you know, how badly are we missing this? I mean, all she did was write a story, and elite media was all over her for doing that.
Well, I think we're sort of at a, you know, little bit of an existential crisis point for a lot of people in media who have to reflect on how this campaign was covered, whether it was covered well enough. I think there's been so many examples of deeply reported pieces on Donald Trump, on his past, on Donald Trump and his supporters and their voices. I mean, I think their voices have been a feature of a lot of the coverage. Stephanie McCrumman's piece in the Washington Post a month ago, it's a long feature about this one woman who is the Trump supporter who said, finally, a person who speaks like me. It had her whole life story. There have been videos of all these people at the rallies and what they have to say, images of these people. Attention paid to the paraphernalia and mementos they're buying from vendors. I mean, a lot of this stuff, this Trump phenomenon has been deeply covered. You know, I think we're challenged by this election because you have a candidate who's out there who is busting through all these sort of behavioral and political and cultural norms. It's fascinating. It's catnip for TV networks. They're going to give far more airtime to Donald Trump than anybody else, because it's going to keep the people watching. I mean, that's obvious. And, you know, you just have to accept that the media has changed. People's views of media have changed. And the reporting that is sort of more traditional sits there and exists on Facebook with a lot of nonsense and a lot of things that are agenda driven, that are false, that are sitting there masquerading as news. And people who live in increasingly hermetically sealed cultural worlds, red state, blue state, rural, urban, whatever, sort of self-select what they want to consume. And so you have to understand all of this, that I mean, the deeply reported pieces by David Fahrenthold, by the New York Times on Donald Trump's tax returns. There are so many great pieces of journalism in this campaign.
I divide the coverage into two distinctly different spheres, one of which is the Trump campaign coverage and the coverage of his finances and his record. And then there's the other sphere would be coverage of the movement and Trump supporters, which you alluded to before. And I think that the latter is where we really failed. We were writing caricatures of wacky Trumpers.
Yes.
Instead of really getting a sense of who these people were, we wrote about the wing nuts and the crazies and dismissed the whole movement as a sort of amalgamation of those kind
and
of
racists.
People.
And racists.
Yeah, and racists too. When that didn't constitute the whole of the movement. And, you know, we were writing these anthropological accounts of the lost tribes of post-industrial America, you know? We weren't really spending time getting to understand that demographic.
I think one piece that stood out to me was once something from BuzzFeed, and it was actually posted a few days before the election, about the week before, and it was called Meet the Ivanka Voter. And it was about the white woman voter, as we saw, who broke for Trump. The majority of them did break for Trump. She doesn't have his sign on her lawn, they write. She's not in the photos of his rally. She doesn't like everything he says, but she's voting for him. And this is the really interesting thing, because this person does not fit the caricature, as we're talking about, of that Donald Trump voter. These are slightly more educated people, maybe a stay-at-home mom, the soccer moms that everybody used to talk about in elections. And she was voting for him partly because of, you know, what he was saying about changing what was happening in Washington. And she didn't agree with what he said. But when it came down to the decision between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, they went with Donald Trump. And Ivanka, they're saying, had a lot to do with that, because they looked at her. They admire her. They say that she is classy and poised and educated and a woman who works and all of that. And that partly made them feel better. I would be really fascinated to have seen what would have happened to Donald Trump if he did not have somebody like Ivanka next to him, endorsing him and talking so and being such an effective surrogate for him on the trail.
I think that's true. I just think there's so much hand-wringing right now about, oh, we've really failed to understand the Trump voter. And I mean, I think that this is not a monolith. I mean, everybody who has asserted that this is not just as simple as a bunch of, you know, rednecks bringing Confederate flags to Trump rallies and shouting at, the media. It's not just those people. That is true. But is it elitist as the media to point out when a candidate or his supporters are espousing obvious racism and misogynistic statements and things like, I mean, I don't think it is. And so, but that plays into this sort of, it hardens that perception among a lot of people that, oh, the mainstream media is looking down on Trump supporters. The mainstream media is casting everybody as racist. And it's just it's incredibly challenging because it is more complex and varied than just to say, you know, to paint everybody who's at a Trump rally with that brush, because a lot of people who show up to Trump rallies don't agree with those people.
There I was think we one would not Reno. Be honest with ourselves or with the listeners if we did not also address the effect that it has had on the reporters who had to cover the campaign to be so attacked
yes.
by Donald Trump every day, but also to face incredible abuse by people who called themselves Trump supporters.
Yes.
You know, there are people in this room who faced unspeakable things. Just some of the most disgusting, not only tweets, but letters and phone calls. I even had one of our reporters come up to me with a letter that was sent to his home that included his middle name, which is not on his byline, that was threatening him because of who he is. I mean, that had to have an effect on how we approached the campaign and how we viewed the people who were supporting him.
Well, also, yes, because as somebody who has received many of those threats, it's definitely jarring, and it does affect you personally. I think something else is not only was it you know, how the supporters reacted, and or you know, they call themselves supporters of Donald Trump, but also the fact that the campaign, while they sent out statements, you know, saying that, you know, they refute any of these types of supporters or anything like that, we never really heard from the candidate himself getting up there and really strongly refusing this type of support.
Well, I mean, he was leading the chance the last 3 weeks of the campaign of CNN sucks, of every rally I was at,
and calling out specific people, reporters,
pointing toward the, yeah, you know, are you reporting that, Katie? I mean, you know, there were all sorts of instances in which at every rally, it was a staple of the rally experience to get to go there, listen to Donald Trump from the stage talk about how dishonest all the people are and how they won't turn their cameras on the crowd, which is nonsense. And everybody's, you know, shared experience was screaming and frothing at the press. I think what's more, you know, I've sat in that press pen a lot, and I've never really, to be honest, felt fear for my safety. I have a pretty thick skin.
You're also a white man.
You're
very tall.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's a lot different for me than for Candace Smith, an African-American woman covering this campaign for ABC, or for a lot of the other women journalists. I think it will be very interesting to watch how he, you know, how if he continues to attempt to limit access by the media as president. And certainly, you know, I don't think there are too many journalists who expect him to change his tune and suddenly, as president, you know, stop responding verbally and publicly to specific reporters and stories that he doesn't like. And that's part of the new normal that we're all living in. But I think journalists have to be very aware of that in terms of how they cover the administration. It's not biased against Donald Trump as a journalist to believe in and fight for and demand access.
There's a big question over whether Donald Trump will even have a White House press pool. We might be facing a situation where the journalists will have to self-organize travel and things like that for President-elect Trump. To this,
explain why that's a big deal, because it's not us being whiny about having to do our own bookings.
No, this is important because I mean, since the early 1900s, the press has been within the White House walls. There's space in there for them to work from. There are daily press briefings and access to the press secretary. And there has always been a protective pool. And this is the group of journalists who follow the president around. And why this is important is yes, the access is important to talking to them, but it's also so that there's an independent set of eyes should anything happen. This is why journalists were so upset when Hillary Clinton left the 9/11 memorial early and had her medical episode, because no reporters were there, because she didn't technically have a full protective press pool who moved with her whenever she moved. So they missed it. And instead, it was bystanders who caught that on video. If it had been reporters, there would have been less confusion about this. In previous years, when the president had meetings abroad with foreign leaders, and there had been moments where the foreign leaders didn't want the press to come into a meeting to see something, it had been White House staffers who had to step up and fight for the media to be able to attend something. As much as the media may have fought with the White House over access and transparency, it was the White House staffers who would stand up and say, no, they need to be here in this meeting between President Obama and President or King, such and such, whatever. We don't know if the Trump team is going to do this.
This is really no small thing.
Now, this is a pillar of our democracy and has been for centuries. And if, for whatever reason, there are attempts to block out reporters from covering this White House, that's going to be a huge story of the first of the transition in the first 100 days for sure.
Next week, our show is driven by you. So please email your questions to nerdcast@politico.com and we will answer them. That is it for us. Thank you so much, Hadas.
Bye, Kristen.
Thanks, Eli.
Thank you.
Ken, thank you.
Fun time as always.
Scott Bland.
Until the next episode.
And Charlie, have fun with the Q&As next week.
You're the best, Kristen.
Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Kookman, and our researcher and Politico producer, Zach Montalaro. And of course, thank you to our listeners. Talk to you next week.